Today's Taisho will be on case one in the Pi Yen Lu, the Blue Rock Collection. Case one is entitled Emperor Wu Asks Bodhidharma, Ask Dhammo. Engo's introduction. Smoke over the hill indicates fire. Horns over a fence indicate an ox. Given one corner, you grasp the other three. One glance, you discern the smallest difference. Such quickness, however, is only too common among robed monks. When you have stopped the deluded activity of consciousness, then whatever situation you may find yourself in, you enjoy perfect freedom in adversity and prosperity, in giving and taking. Now tell me, how in fact will this sort of person behave? See Secho's complications that follow. Main subject, Emperor Wu of Liang asked Bodhidharma, what is the first principle of the holy teachings? Bodhidharma said, emptiness, not holiness. Who is this standing before me? The emperor asked. Not knowing, Bodhidharma said. The emperor did not grasp his meaning. Thereupon, Bodhidharma crossed the river and went to the land of Wei. The emperor later spoke of this to Shiko, who said, do you in fact know who this person is? The emperor said, he told me his name was Not Knowing. Shiko said, this is the Bodhisattva Guanyin, the bearer of the Buddha's heart seal. The emperor was full of regret and wanted to send for Bodhidharma, but Shiko said, it's no good sending a messenger to fetch him back. Even if all the people went, he would not return. Secho's verse, the holy teaching, emptiness. What is the secret here? Again, who stands before me? Not knowing. Thank you so much for coming to practice Zen this morning. These Saturday sits are a wonderful opportunity to practice together very deeply. And just before we had our break, just before I ring the bell, I look around and everybody was in such deep samadhi, deep concentration. That's really wonderful, really excellent. You know, this is a strange thing, right? This is a strange thing. If you go to a normal service at a church or a synagogue or a temple, or a mosque, you know, people are talking, people are performing activities. Everybody here was just sitting in deep samadhi, deep wuxin. And somebody who walked into this room who wasn't familiar with what we're doing would find this really strange. But if they understood what we were doing, they would find it maybe even stranger. Even stranger. You know, Buddhism in general and Zen in particular are strange beasts. Really strange. If you think about it, you know, Buddhism is classified as a religion, and it definitely has many aspects of a religion. It's sometimes classified as a philosophy, and it definitely has many aspects of a philosophy. And I think it's both, and I think it's neither. It definitely has a strange character that sets it apart from most philosophies and any religion I can think of. So for example, When Moses went up Mount Sinai and received the law, he received the Ten Commandments, as everybody knows, carved on stones. And basically, he was told, you know, the basic instruction was, I am the Lord thy God, and thou shalt have no other gods before me. I am the Lord thy God, and thou shalt have no other gods before me. So, you know, when we hear something like that, it makes sense, right? Okay, got it. You're the Lord. I shall have no other gods before me. Okay, got it. That makes sense. It makes sense. If you read the New Testament, you know, Jesus says, I am the truth, the light, and the way. And basically he says, unless you enter through me, you will not, you know, see the Father in heaven. You will not enter the kingdom of heaven. So I am the truth, the light, and the way. And unless you go through me, you will not enter the kingdom of heaven. And, you know, again, that makes a lot of sense. Okay, so, all right, got it. You're the gate and have to enter through the gate. Got it. Okay. In the Quran says, you know, basically, there is no God but Allah, and Muhammad is his prophet. See? Got it. It makes perfect sense, right? It's a clear statement. It's like, accept this truth. Accept this truth. I am the Lord thy God. Thou shalt have no other gods before me. That says, accept this truth. It's something you can hold on to. It's something you can write down. You can keep it in your pocket, right? I am the truth, the light, and the way. And unless you go through me, you will not enter the kingdom of heaven. Got it. It's a clear statement. Now I know what I should believe. Now I know what I should believe. See. There's no God but Allah. It's unambiguous, and Muhammad is his prophet. That settles it. See. So that's crystal clear, affirmative statements of the truth. And, you know, they're asking you to write them down, or they're written down in Holy Scripture, and they're asking you to take hold of this and internalize it and make it the core of your life, right? Okay. So far, you know, that makes total sense. You know, a lot of the time you'll hear people say, if only I had something I could believe in. If there was only something I could believe in. Just give me, I love this song by Bonnie Raitt. I don't know if you're a Bonnie Raitt fan, but she has this wonderful song about an angel from Montgomery. And one of the lines in it is, just give me one thing that I can hold on to. Because this living is a hard way to go, you know. That's so beautiful, right? Give me one thing to hold on to, one thing that's certain in this world. And, okay, there is no God but Allah, and Muhammad is his prophet. Certain. Okay. So, you know, that's religion. It's actually philosophy. It has many of those same qualities. Okay, so now, you know, let's say you get interested in Buddhism, and you can study Buddhism the same way. So there's the Four Noble Truths, you know, the fact of suffering, the illusion of the self, and release from suffering. There's the Eightfold Noble Path, and you can memorize the Eightfold Noble Path, you know, and you can approach Buddhism that way, and many people do. So, you know, Buddha did have the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path, and so on. He did present those. But let's say you go to the bookstore and you see a sutra which is very important for Zen called the Diamond Sutra. And in the Diamond Sutra, the Buddha says all kinds of strange things. He's having a conversation with one of his monks, Subhuti. And he asks Subhuti, he says, basically he says, you know, the Subhuti says to the Buddha, basically, you, the Buddha, came to liberate all beings from illusion. And your dharma, you brought the dharma to liberate all beings from illusion. And the Buddha basically says something like this. He says, you know, actually, if I had a teaching, the Buddha actually says, let me see if I can get this right. Subhuti says to the Buddha, you brought your teaching to liberate all beings from illusion. O Buddha, you brought your teaching to liberate all beings from illusion and from suffering. And the Buddha says, Subhuti, if my teaching was really a teaching, it could not liberate anybody. The teaching is actually no teaching. See, I hope that's making sense. So it says, you know, and the Buddha even goes on, he says, actually, there is no one to liberate and nothing to be liberated from. See? So I really invite you to give the Diamond Sutra a read, but it's going to be a strange experience because the Buddha says, you know, I could say there is no God but Allah, and Muhammad is his prophet. But if I say that to you, actually, that wouldn't liberate you from suffering. And it actually wouldn't help you out of illusion. And he's saying, any statement of the truth that's formulated like that is going to become a source of unhappiness. And so I would say Buddhism is really quite different. You know, the idea that any statement of the truth is not true is that recognition is the path to liberation. In this case, Bodhidharma is a very famous Indian monk who has come to China. And Buddhism is already in China. Buddhism was in China from about the first century of the Common Era. And Zen arrives, Bodhidharma arrives in the fifth century. That's quite a bit later, right? So, you know, longer than the United States has existed, Buddhism was in China before Bodhidharma arrived. And Bodhidharma is bringing this particular teaching, this particular style of practice called Chan, or Zen. And, you know, Emperor Wu of Liang is approaching Buddhism the way a Christian in America might approach Christianity, right? This is the Bible, this is the words of God, you know, study these words and this is something you can hold on to. Or the way you might study the Jewish Bible or the Old Testament, so called, or the way you could study the Quran, right? Here's the truth. It's between these two covers, right? And Emperor Wu of Liang is like that. You know, he's studying the sutras, he's building libraries, he's building temples, and he's got something he can hold on to, right? It's like he's got the Eightfold Path, he's got the Four Noble Truths, and he's trying to live his life according to the law, right? And what happens here is that he has an audience with Bodhidharma has an audience with Emperor Wu of Liang, who's this very devout Buddhist. And Emperor Wu and he meet this very distinguished Indian monk, and the emperor says, what is the first principle of the holy teachings? And Bodhidharma says, emptiness. Forget about holiness, he says. It's emptiness. So, you know, what Bodhidharma is doing is just what the Buddha does in the Diamond Sutra. You know, the Buddha, you know, everybody knows the Buddha came to liberate people from suffering. And what the Buddha says is, there is no teaching. My teaching is no teaching. There is actually no one to liberate. There's actually no one to, and if you believe there's somebody to liberate, you aren't liberated. And you can't be liberated as long as you think that. So this is really different, really strange, right? Buddhism is often taught like a religion. So here are the principles of here's the Old Testament. Here's Genesis, read Genesis. Here's the New Testament. Here's the Quran. You know, you study the principles, right? And what this is doing is like taking them all away. So, you know, if you come out of that tradition where you're looking for something to hold on to, you're looking for something solid that you can believe in, this is going to seem very strange indeed. And yet, you know, the interesting thing is lots of people are interested in Buddhism. And for some reason, you know, when they hear that, when they hear the teaching is no teaching, for some reason, many people find that liberating. You know, actually. And you might say, why do people find that liberating anyway? The teaching is no teaching. You know, how can that be liberating? But there's something about it that's exciting. So, you know, the truth is, I think that the world we live in is a world that we've created, we human beings have created ourselves. And it isn't really real, it's the world we created. So you know, if I have read in scripture that, you know, basically God carved the words of the law on stone and gave the stone tablets to Moses, you know, if you hear that story, if you heard that story for the first time, you know, that God, the creator of the universe, put laws on stones in 10 laws, right? Starting with, I am the Lord thy God, right? And have no other gods before me. And then all the other 9. And later those were put in the Ark of the Covenant, and that was put at the center of the temple in Jerusalem. You know, you would say, that's an amazing story. And there are certainly people who would say, I believe that 100%. I believe that 100%. Or you could maybe, you know, if you read the Christian Bible, you read, you know, Jesus walked on water. You know, Jesus walked on water. And, you know, there are many people who would read that and think, you know, that's amazing. His faith was so great he could walk on water. You know, that's an amazing, ever since I heard that story, it's helped me so much. You know, whenever I'm in a difficult situation, I think of Jesus walking on the water and I realize I can walk on the water too if my faith is only great enough. I believe it. You know, or maybe you believe that an angel dictated the Quran or Allah dictated the Quran to Muhammad. And then Muhammad spoke it to scribes, because Muhammad apparently couldn't write, spoke it to scribes who wrote it down. See, and that's an amazing story, you know, directly from God, you know, basically from God to Muhammad's ear, basically, you know. So you know, you could, you know, for people, there's people who would hear those stories and say, that is amazing, I believe that. But I'm going to go out on a limb and say, actually, I don't think anybody believes that 100%. I don't think anybody believes that 100%. I think when you accept a belief like that, underneath your belief there's a pressure, like, of doubt. right? It's like, really, do you really believe God brought stone tablets to Moses and inscribed on them the Ten Commandments? Do you really believe? And there are people who would die rather than say no. And I'm not saying they're hypocrites. I'm saying they want to believe. They want to believe. They want something to hold on to. But underneath their belief is unbelief, right? Is unbelief. Is this, all beliefs are like this. Every 4 years we see on TV, we hear on TV, get out to vote. Your vote really counts. If you are a mathematician, you know your vote doesn't count, right? You know, I'm going to vote, and I will vote if somebody put a gun to my head, but also in a certain way I know it doesn't count. So underneath my belief is unbelief, right? Underneath my belief is doubt, is I know it's not true. You know, I'm going to do it because it's like my only hope, you know. But I know it's not true, and I want it to be true, right? And all beliefs are like that. You know they're not true, but you want them to be true. And there's always like this pressure involved in maintaining your beliefs, because under your beliefs there's this dark shadow, right? You know, so you know, especially for like fundamentalists, you know. If you read things, fundamentalists talk about doubt obsessively because they can't face doubt, right? They'll say, I began to feel doubt. It's really worrying me, right? And what I have to get out of being in doubt. But, you know, actually, belief and doubt are like yin and yang. Yin and yang. They go together. You know, the things that people believe are not real, any of them, right? They're things humans created. And we know that. We know that on some level, but we don't want to look at that. You know, we don't want to look at it. And so we're always involved in, we put a lot of pressure on ourselves all the time to play the believing game, to believe. And it requires a lot of what psychologists call repression. You know, you have to repress yourself a lot in this world. You have to pretend that things are totally unimportant, are important. And growing up in any society requires you to do this, to pretend that it's important. You know, when I was in high school, I was in a terror. My family was really unhappy. And I wanted to get out of my family and get out of my life. You know, get out of the life I was living on this stupid naval base. And I wasn't an athlete, and I wasn't going to be a movie star. But I realized, you know, I can get good grades in school. So I threw myself into school. I liked to read, and I read like crazy, and I studied like crazy, and I had to get straight A's, right? Straight A's. And if I didn't get an A in every subject, I would, like, torment myself. You realize that that's a belief, right? You know, having to get straight A's is a fantasy. And the very idea of an A and a B and a C, these are things humans invented. You know, if I show my cat, this is a C paper and this is an A paper, he doesn't understand, right? Because it's just a human thing. It's actually a fantasy we created. The idea that people run the marathon, right? And somebody just ran the marathon in under 2 hours, right? You realize it doesn't make any difference. It's totally a symbolic activity, right? You know, it's important in the world of marathons, but you know, outside of the world of marathons, who cares? Who cares? It's totally unimportant. And a century from now, if we don't have enough water to drink, right, people are going to say, why did they waste their time with stuff like that? It was totally unimportant. But all the things we do as human beings, we're cultural animals. We create these symbol systems. We create these values, right? We have to do it.
But it requires a lot of like pressure on ourselves to believe it. You know, it really doesn't matter if you get a B or an A or a C. But you know, growing up in society, you have to buy into the collective dream. You have to accept the collective dream. So you have to say, okay, I'm going to accept that I must do whatever it takes, even if it means staying up all night to get this thing called an A, right? And you'll do it. And then the teacher goes, oh, you're an A student. How wonderful you are, right? That's all like a collective fantasy. And you know, I can remember, because I worked so hard, I was the top student every year in my high school, and I was the valedictorian. You know, and when I was a valedictorian in my high school, I was shocked when it was over how empty it felt, right? It's like my mother, I used to get a little statue every year because I was the best, you know, I had the best grades or something. I got a little award every year for being the top scholar. And my mother would keep them on a shelf, you know, and I remember coming back from college and looking and thinking, does she still have these stupid little statues, you know? And my mother loves, like, these are your statues. You know, and I loved my mother. I'm glad she liked the statues. But I realized in retrospect that I wasted a lot of my time doing something that was making me, I could have had a richer life if I hadn't been so obsessed with grades, right? I was sort of a prisoner. And, you know, in college, I went through sort of an inner struggle because all these people around me were having fun and I was studying all the time. And I was trying to keep the lid on myself, right? And really, you know, keep the lid on. You know, believe. And these doubts kept creeping up. You know, the doubts about, you know, what if I get a B? You know, is it the end of the world? You know, I remember, you know, one of my friends, Tom Steptoe, said, "Do you want to go out and have a beer and some French fries?" And by the way, I had never had beer and French fries till I got to college. And I had a beer and I had hot French fries with beer. Man, is that good! You know, that was amazing. That was like, wow! You know, is this what people do when they're not studying? That's fantastic. So you know, basically, we're constantly putting all this pressure. We have to play the game. Right, because we're around all these other people who expect us to play the game. But our lives are haunted by doubt. And because we know that what we're doing isn't real, right? And the thing is, you know, in psychoanalysis, it's interesting, like in psychoanalysis, people go to a psychoanalyst and they think that there's something inside themselves that they haven't seen. And the psychoanalyst is going to show them what's in there. But that is not how psychoanalysis works, in my opinion. When people go to a psychoanalyst, they already know what's in there. See, they already know. They already know. Like, you know, but they don't want to know. They don't want to admit they know. The psychoanalyst doesn't show them what's in there that's hidden. The psychoanalyst gives the patient permission to admit it's there. See? So in a terrible case, somebody who's been sexually molested, that person knows. But maybe they go into deep depression and they go to the psychoanalyst and they say, I don't know why I'm depressed, right? And the psychoanalyst finally works with the patient and the patient says, oh my gosh, I was sexually molested. I'm not criticizing the patient, but I'm saying the patient already knew. What the patient didn't think he or she could say is, I was sexually molested by my father. See? And there's all this belief on top of this doubt, right? And the person is getting depressed because they're spending a huge amount of energy to keep down what they already know, right? And we all know it's empty. We all know that, but we spend a huge amount of our time pretending that it's not, because we're afraid to take off the lid. We're like the person in psychoanalysis, right? We know it's not real. We know the A is not real. We know the statue on the shelf is not real, right? And actually, usually, you know, in some societies, this kind of a person who makes this discovery can be very bad or can be very good, right? So what's happening right now in our society is really interesting and a little terrifying. Because I think many, many, many people are realizing that the world we live in is not real. That the things we were told were true are not true. And the values we hold are not real, they're invented. See? And, you know, one of the ways this is happening is that we live in a multicultural world, right? So, you know, it's easy to believe that there is no God but Allah, and Muhammad is his prophet, until you meet a Christian, or until you meet a Hindu. And now you're in a fix, right? Because they are worshiping some God, but it's not Allah, right? And you have to, and you can either say, well, I have to force this person to believe in Allah, or you have to say, well, how is this possible? Because my scripture says there's no God but Allah, and you're calling your God Ram, or you're calling your God God, right? And you don't acknowledge the Prophet Muhammad, and you know, and Christians don't acknowledge. I mean, Muslims don't acknowledge Jesus as the Son of God. So you know that can have the effect of ultimately over time, like everybody suddenly realizes none of this stuff is absolutely true, right? And that, I would say, is actually a good thing. That's a good thing. It's like emptiness starts creeping into the world, right? But it makes people uneasy because they don't know how to live with emptiness, you know. But emptiness starts creeping into the world that way. You know, another way that I think emptiness is creeping into our world right now is the environment. See, because we've created this whole system, right? You know, a century ago, people invented the automobile. And man, that is progress, isn't it? You know, you used to have to saddle up your horse, and you used to have to feed your horse grass, and the horse pooped. There was so much horse poop in New York, it was like walking through shit every day. And people used to have, there were people who, there was like, they were like, seriously, like 30,000 people just in charge of picking up the horse poop, right? So, you know, how wonderful that we invented the car. No poop, right? You don't have to keep it in the barn. You don't have to worry about its health, you know. You fill it with gas instead of grass, you know. And you can drive it. You can drive it for like 300 miles on a, you know, on a tank. How wonderful. What could go wrong, right? So that's progress. And so we have, you know, our whole communities are built around cars. Our whole lifestyle is built around the automobile. You know, the biggest industries in the world are petroleum industries. And now, you know, suddenly we realize that our whole way of life is destructive, and it's actually going to put the planet at risk, or it has, you know, and that we could actually go extinct, right? So I think when that happens, one of the reasons people don't want to face this is because it just goes back to like believing that God put, you know, the laws of the universe on stones, right? I mean, that we repress a lot all the time. To just grow up. We have to keep the lid on the emptiness that's always there. And we know this is bullshit. You know, we've always known, right? We've always known that to be the captain of the football team is a totally valueless achievement. It is. It's totally symbolic. It means nothing. You know, it has existential value if you're the captain or you want to be the friend of the captain. But it really means nothing. you know. And we know that, and we don't like to face that, because we say, well, then where am I now? What am I now? See? But what's happening to our culture is, because of all these cultures meeting each other, there's emptiness everywhere. We say, well, I thought God spoke to Muhammad, you know, but apparently God spoke to Jesus, you know, how's that possible, right? Is it all nothing? Is it all nothing? And now we realize our whole civilization is bullshit, right? It's like our whole civilization is based on these destructive, we should never have invented the car. It was a terrible mistake. And we have to change our whole life, right? Everything was a lie, basically, or a fiction, you could say, a fantasy, a collective fantasy, right? So I think Buddhism is becoming popular, is speaking to people now, because people need to learn how to live with emptiness. Emptiness, see? We need to understand that beliefs have never been real. You know, people have so much nostalgia. You know, people whose grandparents were ministers or rabbis, right? And, you know, who you know, you could say, oh, my grandfather, you know, he believed. You know, he just believed. And I actually think that's a fantasy. I think he believed and he didn't believe. And underneath his beliefs, there was this dark shadow of doubt, this dark shadow of emptiness. And now our beliefs are getting blown away, right? You know, after Trump, right? You know, Trump is an example of this. Trump knows that laws are bullshit. He knows they're just pretend. And he breaks them all the time. And all of his followers say, well, you know, they're just laws, you know. If you grow up thinking laws are laws, you know, in a way you're kind of naive, right? You're kind of naive. And Trump has seen the emptiness of all this stuff. But he hasn't been liberated by his insight, see? Trump is like a six-year-old, right? So encountering emptiness can be very dangerous. It can be very destructive. And people like Trump they know it's bullshit. They know it's a fantasy. But they haven't been liberated by their experience of emptiness. It's actually deformed them, right? So emptiness is risky. It's risky. It can be dangerous. And as emptiness is sort of like filling up our society, as it's coming into our world, people like the Trumps of this world, there's going to be more Trumps, basically. But I said a little earlier, people who have this insight can be very good or very bad. Trump is very bad. But, you know, Buddhas and Bodhisattvas also understand the teaching of emptiness. But they have internalized that teaching and they've gone through the process of internalizing it completely. Completely. Trump hasn't internalized it completely, or he wouldn't care about money. He wouldn't care about a penthouse, right? He'd realize that that's bullshit too, right? But Buddhas and Bodhisattvas are people who see the truth of emptiness. Everything is empty. But, you know, if you sit down on the cushion and you enter deep samadhi, and you enter emptiness, you know, at first it can be very uncomfortable. You know, when people are working with the mu koan, you know, at first it can be, you know, you're just sitting with emptiness. You know, actually it could be, some people work with the mu koan for like 3 or 4 years. I remember there was this very famous Zen teacher in Canada. His name is Albert Lowe. But in one of his books on koans, he said, I had the mu koan for 4 years. And he said, I felt like I was sitting in a freezing room in the dark for 4 years, basically. So, you know, if you're looking for something to hold on to, or you're looking, just give me something I can hold on to, you know, it's hard to sit with that emptiness. And that maybe is true for all people, I mean, I found the teaching of emptiness very liberating. It made me feel better because I, in Freudian terms, I have a very strong superego, you know? I put a lot of pressure on myself to conform to social expectations, as you know from my story about trying to get A's in high school. So my superego, my sense of doing what society says was so strong, I was a prisoner. And I made myself ill. But when I began to do Zen and I got into that emptiness, it was like somebody took this huge weight of expectations off my shoulders. Right? I was free. Free. You know. I could admit to myself that it was bullshit. Right? It's all a fantasy. You know? And you meet people every day who can't admit that to themselves, right? I mean, I've told this story before, but I have a friend of mine who's published like 5 books, and he gets depressed because he hasn't published, you know, somebody, he one of his rivals has published 7 books, right? I remember, I don't know if you've ever seen the wonderful movie Little Miss Sunshine, but I highly recommend it. And one of the characters in there is a Proust scholar. And he's tormented because his rival, the other Proust scholar, has put out this book that's getting all this publicity. And he opens a magazine and it says, America's leading Proust scholar, right? And it's not him, it's the other guy. You know, that's so typical, isn't it? I mean, that's what torments us, right? You know? So realizing, you know, it's all fundamentally empty. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. And people will die before they'll give themselves permission to say that. But if you can say it and mean it, it's like taking the weight of the world off your shoulders. Because people seize on anything not to do that. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. See? And if you sit in that emptiness for, 2 or 3 or 4 years, it transforms you, right? And the odd thing is, you would expect that somebody who sees that everything is bullshit, that it's all empty, would turn into a monster like Trump. But as I say, Trump has only gone half the way. He's seen that it's not true, but he hasn't gone the full distance. You know, he still clings to all these illusions. He thinks it's important, for example, to comb his hair over his bald spot, for example, right? Or to live in a ridiculous penthouse, which is, the light fixtures are gilded, you know. It's like a 6-year-old's idea of elegance, right? He's not free. He's in a kind of hell realm. But you know, if you sit in emptiness for a long time, the interesting thing is, you know, that you begin to develop this powerful compassion. You know, this incredible, you know, one of my best friends said she had been meditating and she was walking, I can't remember where she was, but she said she looked at this woman's face and it was like her own face. That's somebody who's done a lot of meditation. You know, it's like everywhere you go, you feel this connection. In the Diamond Sutra, the Buddha says, every time Subhuti says something that the Buddha has taught, the Buddha says, that's just bullshit. You know, there really isn't anybody to be liberated. There really isn't any such thing as liberation. If there was, we couldn't be liberated. And what the Buddha is really saying is, every time we construct some artificial idea or value, we're starting to squash down the emptiness, right, again. He's saying, don't squash down the emptiness. Let it be there. Live in that emptiness. Live in that emptiness. And at one point, the Buddha says, if you do this, the world becomes like your own body. The world, it's like one great, it's like a great body. The mountains and the rivers, you know, the grass, the birds, this is all your body. And so emptiness is actually how we connect with the world. And these values that we hold on to are actually like screens that prevent us from encountering the world. Look, if you're struggling to preserve your image of yourself, you have no time to be compassionate, aware of others, right? You know, Trump is like a famous, he's incredibly unaware of others. It's all about Trump, but this is so typical of somebody who lives in this half light or twilight zone of emptiness, right? He hasn't gone the whole way. If he went the whole, yes, laws are bullshit. They're just artificial. But if you go the whole way, you suddenly realize, you know, everything is myself. Everything is my body. Everything is my life. You know, and so in the ruins, there was a Buddhist university called Nalanda University. And it was destroyed by, we all make mistakes, destroyed by the Turks in the 12th century. And, but in the ruins of Nalanda, they found a little Buddhist statue. And the statue says, seeing emptiness, he feels compassion. So the gate to compassion is emptiness. Seeing emptiness, if all the scriptures were destroyed and people just remembered, seeing emptiness, he feels compassion. The whole of the Dharma would survive, right? Seeing emptiness, he feels compassion. So the whole world becomes your body. So, you know, we're in a place, I think, as a society, where everything is forcing us into emptiness. The environmental crisis in particular is forcing us to see that all of our values were wrong. Everything we believe is bullshit, right? Progress is bullshit, you know, cleanliness is bullshit. Turns out, you know, all these people have autoimmune disorders because we're making the environment too clean, right? You need germs to be healthy. Who would have thought, right? So it's like every day this happens to us, right? And that creates cynicism and people like Trump. But it has the potential to create Buddhas and Bodhisattvas if we practice the great way. If we practice, and we are emptiness is the ocean in which we were born to swim. Our fundamental nature is empty, and is empty, so-called emptiness. And, you know, if you're working with the Mu Koan for a while, it may be uncomfortable, but it will transform you completely. You become the creature of this great sea of emptiness. You become like, you know, like a whale swimming in the ocean of emptiness. You know, that's your true nature. You are that ocean. You're not even the whale. You're the ocean. Smoke over the hill indicates fire. Horns over the fence indicate an ox. This is all the world of our ideas, right? Given one corner, you grasp the other three. One glance, you discern the smallest difference. Such quickness, however, is only too common. When you have stopped the deluded activity of consciousness, when you dwell in emptiness, then, whatever situation you may find yourself in, you enjoy perfect freedom. In adversity and prosperity, in taking and giving. Now tell me, how in fact will this sort of person behave? Emperor Wu of Liang asked Dhammo,
what is the first principle of the holy teachings? Dhammo, Bodhidharma said, forget about holiness, emptiness. Who is this standing before me? The emperor asked. Not knowing, said Bodhidharma. The emperor did not grasp his meaning. Thereupon, Bodhidharma crossed the river and went into the land of Wei. The emperor later spoke of this to Shiko, who was also a monk. He was a monk at court, who said, Shiko said, do you know who that guy was? And the emperor said, he said his name was Not Knowing. Shiko said, that is Guan Yin. That is the embodiment of compassion. To dwell in seeing emptiness, he feels compassion. The bearer of the Buddha's heart seal. The emperor was full of regret. He's a very good man, right? And he wanted to send for Bodhidharma, but Shiko said, it's no good sending a messenger to fetch him back. Even if all the people went, he would not return. See, now the emperor has his first taste of emptiness. So good things are going to happen now. The holy teaching, emptiness. What is the secret here? Again, who stands before me, not knowing? It's a little bit more to the poem. Inevitable, the thorns and briars springing up. Secretly by night he crossed the river. All the people could not bring him back. Now, so many years by, still Bodhidharma fills your mind. In vain. He says, don't think of Bodhidharma. Emptiness. A gentle breeze pervades the universe. The master looks around. Is the patriarch there? Yes, bring him to me. He can wash my feet. So don't even hold on to the idea of Bodhidharma.